Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved, and its host and founder is Carol Marx. Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick off this hour of our program with Carol Marx in conversation with author Linda Graham, who wrote a book titled Resilience: Powerful Practices for Bouncing Back from Disappointment, Difficulty, and Even Disaster. Linda Graham is a licensed marriage and family therapist and mindful self-compassion teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area. She integrates neuroscience, mindfulness, and relational psychology in her international trainings, conferences, workshops, and webinars.
My first question has to do with the word resilience, because it's the title of your book. And can you give us a good definition of the word? And does our definition of what resilience means really evolve over time?
Resilience has traditionally been thought of as traits of grit or determination or the will to survive, the will to endure. And as the behavioral science research and the neuroscience research comes together, the behavioral sciences have found that there are three factors or three elements that predict someone's resilience or capacity to bounce back from the challenges and crises that are inevitable in life, the capacities to cope with adversity. And the three elements are the severity of the external stressor. In other words, our resilience may be shaped by whether we're dealing with a fender bender, or are we dealing with a car accident that caused an injury, or are we dealing with causing the death of a child in a car accident. So the severity of the stressor impacts how resilient we'll be. The strength of our external resources. Do we have family and friends to call on? Do we have financial resources, medical resources, counseling resources? And the third element is those internal qualities, those internal capacities of determination and perseverance and our own courage in facing difficulties. The neuroscience comes in and says, you know what, resilience is a capacity innate in our being because it's innate in our brain. It's one of the capacities of the higher brain, the center of executive functioning, to shift our responses to whatever is happening. It's the quality of response flexibility. So when we can perceive what's happening and our reactions to what's happening, but then be able to pause and step outside and shift our perspective to a larger perspective, then we're able to discern what options are available to us, what choices we can make. And so the book is about offering exercises, there's 130 of them, to strengthen that capacity in the brain, to be able to respond to life events flexibly, adaptively, skillfully, and quickly recover our resilience.
What I learned and surprised me the most after I read your book was the fact, you know, you said that our capacity for resilience comes from our brain, but I didn't realize that it only comes from your brain once it's mature, functioning well, and has fully developed. And I didn't realize that where it develops is in the prefrontal cortex, and that is in the front of the brain. And I guess that's the last to develop, and we don't often think about that, you know, say the way a teenager acts.
Well, so let's clarify. The prefrontal cortex, this structure in the brain that is the center of executive functioning, is not fully developed until we're about 25 years of age. So, yes, that's why teenagers don't have the structure fully developed yet that will manage their impulses, that will manage their emotions, that gives them a sense of who they are and who other people are. However, resilience is a capacity, this capacity to shift our responses, that can be manifested early on. It's developed in our earliest relationships with our caregivers, with people around us who can model being resilient, showing us how to cope, but also being held in relationship where we feel seen and understood and valued and important, where our own resilience is seen and validated. That's also part of how it develops in the brain. So young children can be resilient if that's what they see around them, and if their own capacities to recover when they don't get to have the third cookie, you know, when those capacities are validated, then young people, even teenagers, adults, can be resilient. What I'm looking at in the book is how to strengthen or recover those capacities, because we all face challenges that can sometimes overwhelm that resilience temporarily or even for a long time. So how do we strengthen the capacities of the brain to go to those resilient behaviors fairly automatically?
Let me tell you that another thing that really it surprised me, because I had heard of the word neuroplasticity, and I've heard, well, it's connected with the brain, but I never really understood how amazing neuroplasticity is and what it enables our brains to do. So can you briefly and in really layman's terms tell us what happens, what the prefrontal cortex is able to do? It's amazing.
So it's been only in the last 25 years or so of modern neuroscience that the scientists have been able to see neuroplasticity in action in a living brain. And up until then, the science was that the brain didn't change after it fully matured, that you couldn't teach an old dog new tricks. But now that we know neuroplasticity is not just the exception, it's actually the rule, it's the norm in the brain, that the brain can grow new neurons lifelong, it can create new neural circuitry lifelong, it can wire and rewire itself lifelong. So now we're learning how to harness that neuroplasticity. The brain learns from experience. The brain always learns from experience. So when you have an experience, that causes neurons in the brain to fire. If you repeat the experience, then those neurons will strengthen the connections between them and create new neural circuitry. So when you cultivate an experience like cultivating a gratitude practice, focusing your attention, deepening your listening skills, cultivating more self-awareness and more self-acceptance, the more you repeat those experiences, the stronger the circuitry becomes in the brain that can use those experiences, that can remember to go there. So,
how long do you, you know, why do you say that you have to repeat these new habits or things? And, you know, the obvious question is, well, how often do you have to do them? And how long do you have to continue to do them? And if you stop, you know, doing, say, writing in a journal for gratitude, which I think would be very helpful. So what kind of guidelines do you have as far as the time involved in getting this new habit firmly entrenched in your prefrontal cortex?
Right. So the scientists do not agree on how many times you have to repeat an experience to make it a habit. The research is not consistent. What we do know is that the brain learns best when you have experiences little and often. Small experiences so that the brain can actually incorporate it, but repeated, 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 repeated. They don't know how long, how often, but the brain learns best when we do something small and repeat it many, many times. So if you're cultivating, you put your hand on your heart to calm down your nervous system, and you practice doing that 5 times a day, and you practice it every day for a week, or you practice it every day for 30 days. There's no magic number, but the more you get used to doing that behavior as a habit, there's a stress, there's a disturbance, there's a startle, your hand goes to your heart, you breathe deeply, you calm down your nervous system. That becomes more and more of an automatic go-to pattern in the brain. And the more we repeat it, the more automatic it becomes. When we're stressed out or tired, the brain will default to what it automatically knows how to do. So that's why we train the brain to go to the new pattern over and over and over again, so that in fact, eventually, it becomes more automatic to go to the new pattern. But each person is going to be different. Each person is going to be different in how disciplined they are to use the tools and practice them, and how quickly their brain will build that new neural circuitry. It is important to use conscious reflection, conscious awareness, because the more we are aware of creating a new pattern, the more we reflect on, oh, I just did that. This pattern is becoming stronger. The more we bring conscious awareness to it, the easier it is for the brain to record a new habit.
Well, Linda, you know, the exercise in your book that I found most helpful was the one you just talked about, a hand on the heart. And I never realized until, you know, till I did it, that when you put your hand on your heart, you really do have a feeling of warmth.
That's Carol Marks in conversation with author Linda Graham, who wrote Resilience, Powerful Practices for Bouncing Back from Disappointment, Difficulty, and Even Disaster. We'll have more of the conversation between Carol Marks and Linda Graham when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
Ooh, get the stinky dog away from me.
Bad breath and bad gas.
Petey stopped eating. All his hair fell out.
Itching, licking, missing fur.
At least $5,000 in vet bill.
Creams, antibiotics, sprays.
No results.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite.
Dinovite. .com.
If you want the dog to be healthy, you got to feed it something healthy.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite is nutrition.
The shedding has stopped and the itching has stopped.
Her coat is not soft. It's silky. It's healthy and shiny and glossy.
She's got life. She's got energy.
Tons of energy. No more bad smell.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Dynavite is the best thing that's ever happened to my dogs, you know, besides me, of course.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dynavite for life.
Dinovite. .com.
Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Al Herskovitz is an 87-year-old Korean war vet who, following his service to America, embarked upon a 68-year career in radio. In his new book, The Tall, Skinny Jewish Kid with Eyeglasses from Bridgeport, he recalls the fascinating characters he met as a child of immigrants, a soldier, and a radio broadcaster. These include showbiz celebrities, sports stars, politicians, international spies, and even a few mobsters. Al crossed paths with hundreds of fascinating figures, from Kate Smith to Bob Dylan to Benjamin Netanyahu. His story set against the backdrop of almost 9 decades of American history, wars, protests, rapidly evolving pop culture, and social norms. The Tall, Skinny Jewish Kid with Eyeglasses from Bridgeport. Get your copy now in paperback or Kindle on Amazon.com, published by Talkers Books.
This is Brad Shepard. Whenever you think of Social Security, do you think of survivor's benefits too? You see, Social Security is more than retirement. Social Security makes regular monthly payments to the families of workers who die too. More than 7 million people get survivor's benefits from Social Security, including almost 2 million children. Benefits that pay for food and clothing, medical care, and school benefits you can count on when you're planning your financial future. For more information, go to the SSA website at www.ssa.gov.
Continuing listening now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Let's get back to the conversation between the host of our program, Carol Marx, and author Linda Graham, who wrote Resilience, Powerful Practices for Bouncing Back from Disappointment, Difficulty, and Even Disaster.
And the other thing that I thought was very helpful was while you were doing breathing properly, gently, and putting your hand on your heart, that if you also thought for just 1 minute about a time when you felt safe and loved by another human being, that that was a thing that was very, very affirming when the human being did it.
Mm-hmm. You know, so human beings are hardwired to connect with other human beings in times of danger or life threat. That's evolution. That's our biology. So when we take advantage of that, there's a moment of startle, hand on the heart, breathe more deeply to calm down the nervous system, and then remember a moment, just one moment, not the whole relationship, but remembering one moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished with another human being, that activates the oxytocin in the brain. It's the brain's hormone of safety and trust, and it's the brain's direct an immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So when we remember feeling safe and get that feeling of safety in our body, then we actually can calm down the stress response. In fact, if you feel safe enough, if you practice that regularly, you can preempt the stress response from happening in the first place. The body starts to react and then it just fades away. So I do teach, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do teach the hand on the heart exercise to all my clients in every workshop, asking people, you know, to do that many times a day until it becomes a habit for them, because it's one of the fastest ways we have of restoring the physiological equilibrium, the range of resilience to our body brain. So, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's a really powerful technique.
And, you know, what's amazing is that, as you had said a little earlier, now today they're able to see that the prefrontal cortex is able to have its neurons make changes, and that there are actually changes in the X-ray in someone's prefrontal cortex after they've had one of these calming exercises. That's quite amazing. I mean, if people saw that, it would certainly motivate them to do these exercises. A lot of which are just very, very simple things, like a hug.
Right. I'm glad that you mentioned the point about motivation, because as we do these exercises and experience the benefit of them, they become self-reinforcing, so that we're more likely to do these practices again because we've experienced the benefit of doing them. And yes, a hug, when you're hugging a person that you feel safe with and comfortable with, is one of the fastest ways we have to recover that sense of safety, of connection, of belonging. I'm not the only one. You know, everyone goes through something like this, and everyone can help calm me down. Well, not everyone. It has to be a person that you feel safe with and responsive with. But when we experience the benefit of it, then we're more likely to keep repeating it and develop a discipline to keep repeating it.
Now, we've talked about some of the our body's, you know, innate senses being the most helpful in being able to get through difficult times. And, you know, we talked about such senses as touching and breathing. And your book also says movement. So is something like yoga, can that be helpful in having us be more positive when we are experiencing a lot of stress?
Yes, so we're talking about our somatic intelligence, our body-based intelligence to recover our resilience. And when people use techniques of breath and touch and movement and visualization, that's using the body itself to help us come back into this range of resilience. And movement work, certainly yoga, tai chi, qigong, these movement exercises work partly because there's movement and there's mindfulness. We're paying attention to the movement of the body, and that's part of doing the rewiring and becoming resilient. So that we can move in positive ways, you can stand tall and stand strong and put your arms over your head, and, you know, in a feeling of triumph. And that can create, that shifts the energy in the body. It can create a sense of strength, which is useful before you go into a job interview or a courtroom or a business meeting. But we also use movement to rewire previous memories held in the body, so that if you evoke a sense of fear or anger or disappointment or shame, and you feel what that feels like in your body, and then you allow your body to move to the opposite posture, and you go back and forth several times, the new, more positive, stronger posture can actually help rewire or fade away the previous body memory. So we're using these tools both to create new neural circuitry and to rewire the old circuitry when it's less than resilient.
That's Linda Graham, the author of Resilience, Powerful Practices for Bouncing Back from Disappointment, Difficulty, and Even Disaster. The interview is conducted by the host of our program, Carol Marks. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we'll have more of A Touch of Gray featuring Carol Marks in conversation with Kurt Smith, author of The Presidents of the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House, when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
Pain doesn't take vacations. It never celebrates holidays. It's on the job 24/7 to keep your life exactly where it is, in limbo. But it doesn't have to be that way, because Laser Spine Institute can help you take back your life from chronic neck and back pain. With a less than 1-inch incision, our minimally invasive procedures have provided relief to over 60,000 patients with a 97% patient satisfaction rate. So get ready to stand tall and live the life you've imagined for yourself without pain. Are you or a loved one suffering from a bulging disc, herniated disc, spinal stenosis, pinched nerve, or degenerative disc disease? Call our spine care consultants now for a no-cost MRI review and to learn more. It's time to say goodbye to chronic neck and back pain. What have you got to lose? Laser Spine Institute, the leader in minimally invasive spine surgery.
Call 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK. That's 855-730-BACK.
Hi, this is Michael Harrison. I hope you're enjoying this installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, and finding it to be a meaningful listening experience. This wonderful little weekend program has been on the radio across America in one form or another for more than 20 years. Its mission is to provide mature Americans with information and content about aging to help them cope with the nonstop challenges of life during these hectic modern times. We're talking about health, finances, relationships, and plain old fun. Whether it's learning about the latest technology and social norms, or fondly remembering yesterday's arts and entertainment, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, is dedicated to serving that gigantic segment of the population so sadly ignored by most of today's popular media. Founded and hosted by a truly great lady, Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the ongoing battle against ageism, this program is geared to what has commonly been referred to as the sandwich generation. Baby boomers who are coping with such challenges as still supporting their adult children while caring for their elderly parents. It's my honor and privilege to be associated with Carol Marks and be a part of her mission to support, defend, and inspire today's generation of what she lovingly calls seasoned citizens. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, online at www.atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. And right here on this great radio station every weekend. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Brad Shepard. Whenever you think of Social Security, do you think of survivors' benefits too? You see, Social Security is more than retirement. Social Security makes regular monthly payments to the families of workers who die too. More than 7 million people get survivors' benefits from Social Security, including almost 2 million children. Benefits that pay for food and clothing, medical care, and school benefits you can count on when you're planning your financial future. For more information, go to the SSA website at www.ssa.gov.
Michael Harrison here. Those of you who follow talk radio and are interested in what goes on behind the scenes might also know me as the publisher of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication that serves the talk media industry. We cover the talk show business as it exists on radio, television, and the internet. I often have the opportunity to speak about these media as a guest on radio and TV talk shows or comment on industry developments in newspapers and magazines. For the past 3 years, I've also hosted a weekly podcast that features interviews with fascinating people from a variety of fields and walks of life. It's designed to be enjoyed by media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Recent guests include such interesting folks as former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, Richard Nixon's grandson Christopher Nixon Cox, Alex Jones, Freddie Boom Boom Cannon, Deepak Chopra, Dr. Alan Stern, the principal investigator of NASA's New Horizons Pluto mission, radio broadcasters Sean Hannity, Mike Francesa, and Joe Piscopo, and legendary WWE ring announcer Lillian Garcia. How's that for variety? Each week, I interview outstanding personalities from the world of radio or any number of its related fields in the arts, science, entertainment, politics, or academia. It's available to download, and you can subscribe to it at absolutely no charge whatsoever at Apple Podcasts or at the website mhinterview.com. The Michael Harrison Interview. Just a click away on your computer or mobile device. Visit Apple Podcasts or mhinterview.com. Make the Michael Harrison Interview a weekly podcast listening experience. This week on the Michael Harrison Interview, a fascinating conversation about rock, radio, and real estate.
Don't do what I did and run out.
If it's working, don't quit. Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished?
You've got to feed them right for life.
Dynavite is nutrition.
If I ever took Roy off of Dynavite.
No.
When I get to about 3/4.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dynavite.com.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
Order a 90-day supply of Dynavite for your dog this week.
We'll send you 4 extra packs of Nubba-Nubs. Free.
Nubba-Nub treats are freeze-dried beefy treats.
Made with no cereal fillers, chemical preservatives, or dyes.
Good for the tummy.
And yummy.
Nubba-Nub treats.
Free. This week at Dynavite.com.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite.
Dynavite for life.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Here again is our host and founder, Carol Marks, in conversation with Kurt Smith, author of The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House.
Now, I've got to ask you first, what got you interested in learning as a child about baseball and the American presidency, and why do you call the relationship between America's presidents and the game of baseball mythical?
Well, this dates back really to, I guess, some of my earliest memories. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York of about 2,000 people. I call it Mayberry without the accent. And I am told by my mom that as a little kid, 6, 7 years old, my parents, like any good parents of the 20th century, bought the World Book Encyclopedia for our family, and I would take the World Book onto the front porch of our home, and I would become fixated by it, enamored by it, and I would turn day after day to biographies of America's presidents. It might be Lincoln, it might be Washington, another day it might be a Woodrow Wilson or Dwight Eisenhower, and I would also turn to a baseball and the game itself but Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, Tris Speaker, Jackie Robinson. And ultimately, these became two of the great loves of my life, not simply professionally and personally. And I think I have Carol a great deal of company here, because if you look and listen to people, not simply men alone, but perhaps disproportionately men, we have an opinion. We have an opinion on politics, particularly the presidency. And I think sports, not limited to baseball, but disproportionately baseball. And we think often that we know a great deal about both. We don't necessarily, but we think we do. And we have an opinion about each. And I have found over the years that the great majority of Americans with which and whom I have come in contact with, not simply as an author, but as a former speechwriter to President George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush in the White House, that Americans really do love these two institutions because they're ours. They were born here.
Absolutely.
They originated here, the presidency and also this great game of baseball.
And I was, you know, learned so much from your book. And you wrote that the America's president's interest in a form of baseball goes back to George Washington. I never would have thought about that. Now, what does he do with his trips at Valley Forge?
Well, you know, Washington, as we know, before he was a president, he was a general. And had he not been a general, he never would have been president, and we wouldn't be talking about the United States as a nation. We would probably still be some number of colonies under the mother country. But you're quite right, Carol. The game of baseball derives from the British form of baseball called rounders. And Washington, in that terrible winter of 1777-78 at Valley Forge in eastern Pennsylvania, when the colonies were on the ropes and Great Britain held all of the cards, military and strategic and economic, and Washington was in near, not hysteria necessarily, but he was in near despair. He would play rounders, throwing this ball back and forth with his aide-de-camp for hours because his army couldn't move. And he had no faculties for his army to do anything. And so he had to mentally strategize. What comes next? How do I get out of this? How do I get out of this box? And he found relaxation in throwing a ball back and forth with his aide-de-camp for hours. And ultimately, the thaw came, and he got help from the Marquis de Lafayette. And as students of history knows, fortunes got better for the colonies, and ultimately he became our first president. But you're right. Before he even became president, he was a general, and baseball was part of his daily routine.
Now, you know, what really surprised me was what Lincoln did early in his career, and when he was president, that helped cement baseball's favorite pastime. And I just couldn't believe what he did with his love of baseball when he was in the White House. I mean, my goodness, did he really play it there?
Well, there are several anecdotes that I include in the book, The Presidents and the Pastime. One occurred in 1860 in Springfield, Illinois, and the Republican convention was being held in Chicago. And a delegation of Republican dignitaries traveled from Chicago to Springfield to tell him that he had received enough votes from the delegates to give him the Republican presidential nomination. And, of course, ultimately he became our 16th president. Well, Lincoln was playing a game of baseball, or it was then referred to as town ball. And he received the dignitaries in a fashion by saying, I appreciate that you come to me apparently with good news, but you will have to wait my next time at bat.
And that's
so
something.
He kept them waiting while he strode to the plate and apparently got a single with his next time in bat. So this is a man that already had his priorities rather in order. And so he becomes the nominee and then becomes the president. And then alluding, Carol, to what you were referring to, as president, he took town ball to the White House and inside the White House. First of all, he played games outside on what was then referred to as the White Lot, or as we refer to it today as the Ellipse. It's where the National Christmas tree is lit every December. He had a blast with that. He really did love the game. But then he did the incomparable and almost impossible by taking baseball inside. You know, we think of the first baseball indoor stadium as the Houston Astrodome, which debuted in 1965. Well, here you've got Lincoln in 1861 and 1862, and he's a century ahead of the curve by taking the game inside. And he's running up and down, and I've got accounts which provide a vivid description of him running up and down the corridors of the White House. And I'm not quite sure whether he fashioned the corridors as base paths or how long the corridor between home plate and first base might have been. But I do know that he was 6 feet 4 inches tall, and there are vivid descriptions of his angular frame and the gigantic steps that he would take, and it must have been quite a sight to see him in full flight after he had hit the ball. So he
couldn't
had a great joy, and it must have given him an enormous respite, as particularly in the early part of the war, as the tide turned against the North.
Now, we mentioned earlier that you were a chief speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush for many, many years, and also after he left office. And his love for baseball started, like yours, when he was very young, and that was quite a coincidence. So what did he say when he was first at bat?
Well, he was a much better player than I was. That's not saying much. Almost anyone would have been a better player. My joy came in part from playing, but largely from reading. He was the great athlete. And I once asked him when it was he first knew that he loved the game. And he paused for a moment. He said, you know, when I first picked up a bat and swung it. And I said, well, Mr. President, when was that? And he said, oh, age 5. 5 years old, and he describes to himself and to me why he loved the game. And he said because it occurred to him that, quote-unquote, baseball has everything. Well, what a wonderfully precise and concise way of describing baseball's allure. Well, President Bush, the future president, was 5 years old, and he recently turned 94. That's 89 years of loving the game. And he went on to become a wonderful prep school player. He then went on to become, after he returned from World War II, the captain of his baseball team at Yale, the first two teams, incidentally, to ever enter a college World Series. And a Major League scout once told me that he was such a marvelous fielder, he played first base, that had there been the position at the time of designated fielder, as there is today designated hitter, that Bush would have made the major leagues. He was that sterling a fielder. But, of course, he had the problem that I have had and that tens of millions of other millions of Americans have had, that he couldn't hit a lick. So he never seriously entertained a baseball career. But he was a spectacular fielder and a great aficionado in every phase of loving the game. And, of course, his son has loved the game. Bush would often tell me that he coached his four sons in Little League in Texas, and his late and dear wife Barbara of 73 years. Bush would often say he thought at times had carpooled every Little Leaguer in the state of Texas. So
wow.
Baseball ran very deep in the DNA of the Bush family, and in a sense still does.
And, you know, I guess I had heard about it before, but forgotten, that President Franklin Roosevelt really saved baseball really during World War II, and I never realized that the baseball leagues and their owners asked for his opinion about stopping the playing of baseball during the war. So what made him read at a press conference a letter he had written in response to the people that were saying that maybe it wasn't a good thing to continue baseball when the country was at war?
No, you're absolutely right, and that's a very accurate description. Franklin Roosevelt, who of course was the only president elected more than twice, he was elected four times, and because of the 22nd Amendment, which precludes any president from serving more than two successive terms, will be the only president ever to serve more than twice. He adorns the cover of the presidents in the pastime. And my point is, how could he not? Because he quite literally is the spine around which the book entwined. He saved the game. There's no question of that. And as you suggest, after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, Major League Baseball was turned upside down. It was not atypically clueless. It didn't know which way to turn. Should it close up shop? Should it go out of business? Should it try to proceed in a diminished state for the rest of the war? Because in the end, more than 250 of its very best players were drafted. They went abroad, for the most part, to the Pacific and to the European theaters. So the owners and the commissioner was Kenesaw Mountain Landis, without doubt the greatest commissioner in the history of the game, didn't know in what capacity baseball should be staged, if any. So what Landis did was on January 14th, 1942, and that's only 5 weeks after Pearl Harbor, he wrote a letter to FDR. And the very next day, this is how important baseball was to the morale and the state of the nation. The very next day, Roosevelt held a press conference, and he read out loud the entirety of the letter that he had just composed to Judge Landis. And in that letter, FDR did not simply gently suggest that baseball should be played. He, in effect, ordered that baseball should be played for the duration of the war, until it was assumed, and of course this is what occurred, America should win, and did win, total victory over the Axis powers of Germany, Italy, and Japan. And what Roosevelt said was this, that baseball was so important to the temper and to the morale of the nation that it must be played. It was important to the morale of what came to be known as the home front, and that is the workers, the housewives, the children of the nation here at home, that it was that vital, crucial to them. But above all, that it was important to the troops abroad, to the 16 million American troops that ultimately wore the uniform of the United States and that went abroad to do the fighting. And he was right, because later surveys showed that except for letters from loved ones here at home to the troops abroad, nothing more lifted the morale of those troops than to read in newspapers abroad of box scores and game accounts of baseball here at home. Fiorello LaGuardia and Wendell Willkie had both publicly urged that FDR do this because they made that very point. And Roosevelt had been inclined that way in any event. He knew his country and he knew his game, which is why I suggest in the presidents in the pastime that Franklin Roosevelt be inducted posthumously into the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York, where I was, in fact, yesterday to speak and where I was several weeks ago as well, because there are today, Carol, 317 plaques at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown honoring the great players and executives and other noteworthies of baseball's past. And none of them include this phrase, saved baseball. Franklin Roosevelt saved baseball.
Kurt Smith, author of The Presidents in the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House. The interview is conducted by the host of our program, Carol Marks. Coming up next, another installment in the ongoing adventures of Meg McDonald. The feature is called Meg, and it's one of the most popular features at Talkers.com. That's coming up next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here on this great talk radio station in just a moment.
Get the stinky dog away from me.
Bad breath and bad gas.
Petey stopped eating. All his hair fell out.
Itching, licking, missing fur.
At least $5,000 in vet bill.
Creams, antibiotics, sprays.
No results.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite. Dinovite. com.
If you want the dog to be healthy, you gotta feed it something healthy.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite is nutrition.
The shedding has stopped and the itching has stopped.
Her coat is not soft. It's silky. It's healthy and shiny and glossy.
She's got life. She's got energy.
Tons of energy. No more bad smell.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Dynavite is the best thing that's ever happened to my dogs, you know, besides me, of course.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dynavite for life.
Dinovite. com.
Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics. Also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com.
Back pain doesn't take vacations. It never celebrates holidays. It's on the job 24/7 to keep your life exactly where it is, in limbo. But it doesn't have to be that way, because Laser Spine Institute can help you take back your life from chronic neck and back pain. With a less than 1-inch incision, our minimally invasive procedures have provided relief to over 60,000 patients with a 97% patient satisfaction rate. So get ready to stand tall and live the life you've imagined for yourself without pain. Are you or a loved one suffering from a bulging disc, herniated disc, spinal stenosis, pinched nerve, or degenerative disc disease? Call our spine care consultants now for a no-cost MRI review and to learn more. It's time to say goodbye to chronic neck and back pain. What have you got to lose? Laser Spine Institute, the leader in minimally invasive spine surgery.
Call 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK. That's 855-730-BACK.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast, and the subject is phobias, otherwise known as fears. We all have fears. Some of them are quite rational. Some of them are irrational. Some people are afraid of the dark. Common fears include fear of flying, fear of spiders, fear of heights. One of the big ones is speaking in front of an audience, fear of public speaking. Now, there's a little-known phobia out there called stovophobia. That's right. And Meg, our observer of everything, is here to talk about being stovophobic, or in other words, a fear that she developed later in life during her transition into becoming a domestic goddess.
I am the middle of three sisters, and growing up, I was a tomboy and a late bloomer. I rode horses, shoveled manure, and played with trucks. And it wasn't until after I graduated from high school that I started wearing makeup. My older sister was a great cook. Me, I don't do kitchen well. When I moved out on my own, I thought the TV dinner was the best invention ever. You have your entree, vegetables, and dessert all right there. How convenient. When I got married, my husband did the cooking and I did the dishes. He would do the laundry and I would do the taxes. We had a great marriage. And like Rocky Balboa said about Adrian, we filled in each other's gaps. And it worked out well for 30 years. Until one day, I became a widow, and the division of duties stopped, and all those skills I never learned and appliances I never used were right in front of my face, and they were like strangers to me. I made friends with the microwave first, and we've become very close. I don't do anything fancy and only buy microwavable meals that require the high setting. The washer and dryer and I have become colleagues, although I still get nervous when the washer goes into high spin speed and shakes until it reaches velocity. But I'm no longer afraid that it will dance away from the wall. We all have common fears that we don't mind sharing with each other, fear of heights, small spaces. But then we have our private fears, fears we're too embarrassed to admit except to ourselves. I had one of those fears for 2 years. I was afraid of the stove. We have a pilotless stove, so when you turn the knob to light a surface burner, it makes a clicking noise to trigger the flame. The clicking noise scared me. What if it just keeps clicking and a flame never appears? Thing about private fears is they simmer inside you until they reach a full boil, and the only way to release the pressure is to share, which I finally did with a dear friend. And without hesitation, she gave me the warmest smile and said, "Oh, honey, I can show you how it works," which she did. And now I feel so liberated. It's such a relief to know I can use the stove any time I want. I'm not sure what I'll cook. I need something. What is it called? A recipe.
And that, of course, is Meg. And Meg is always a recipe for interesting observations. If you want more of Meg, Meg McDonald, check out all the Megs at talkerslive.com. That's talkerslive.com. And that about does it for this hour of our broadcast. I want to thank Dwayne Doobie Jr., our producer on the front line, who pulls all of these pieces together and makes it happen. Of course, a salute to the great Carol Marks, our host and founder, and to our affiliates coast to coast. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.